Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, December 13th, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline from today's paper is Drug Conspiracy Linked to Cartel. Interagency cooperation leads to arrest and convictions of fentanyl traffickers, by David Golbitz. Flanked by members of federal and metro area law enforcement agencies, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa, Richard Westfall, touted interagency cooperation for the arrests, convictions, and sentencing of 11 members of a fentanyl distribution conspiracy. Triggered by an overdose death in January 2022 in Council Bluffs, local, state, and federal law enforcement officers worked together to bring the group to justice that was responsible for distributing these drugs, Westfall said Wednesday at a Council Bluffs press conference. The law enforcement agencies involved in the investigation included the Council Bluffs, Omaha, and Bellevue Police Departments, the Southwest Iowa Narcotics Enforcement Task Force, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the FBI. Together, these officials investigated the conduct of this crime enterprise, both here in western Iowa, in Council Bluffs area, and in eastern Nebraska, in Omaha and Lincoln, Westfall said. After countless hours doing surveillance and other investigative work, including the execution of 14 search warrants, law enforcement seized 1,500 fentanyl pills, 3 firearms, and $45,000, Westfall said. The 11 conspirators were convicted of a variety of crimes, including conspiracy to distribute fentanyl, carrying firearms in furtherance of the distribution of fentanyl, and distribution of fentanyl resulting in death or serious bodily injury, with sentences ranging from 3.5 years to 30 years in federal prison. This group was responsible for distributing over 100,000 pills in the Iowa-Nebraska area, Westfall said. This resulted in 17 overdoses, 6 of those resulting in death. And for the 11 that weren't resulting in death, those individuals, most of them, if not all of them, required life-saving medical intervention to bring them back to life. That's how dangerous this drug is. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the United States, the rate of overdose deaths involving synthetic opioids in 2021 was nearly 22 times the rate in 2013. Steve Bell, assistant special agent in charge of the DEA's Omaha office, explained that as little as 2 milligrams of fentanyl is enough to kill an average person. In 2023, the DEA has seized more than 180,000 fake pills in Nebraska and Iowa that contained fentanyl, Bell said. What makes matters worse is we're seeing fentanyl in cocaine, we're seeing it in methamphetamine, and we're seeing it in other synthetic drugs, Bell said. So there is absolutely no way to tell any user out there what they're actually taking, but because we're seeing fentanyl basically in everything. Overdose deaths are the leading cause of death for ages 18 to 49, according to the CDC. In 2022, there were over 100,000 accidental drug poisonings in the United States, Westfall said. 80% of those were fentanyl. In the millions of pills the DEA has seized, 6 in 10 illicit pills contain a lethal dose of fentanyl. According to the Iowa Office on Drug Control Policy, overdoses accounted for 237 deaths in the state in 2022. With more than 200 caused by fentanyl. Gene Cowell, special agent in charge of the FBI's Omaha field office, provided more detail into the investigation and how so many law enforcement agencies came to work together. On January 6, 2022, the Pottawatomie County 911 Communications Center received a call for a 33-year-old woman who was found unconscious and not breathing, Cowell said. Upon the arrival of police, fire, and rescue, she was pronounced dead. She'd purchased 2 pills, Cowell said, And the first ones, the first pill's toxicity, excuse me, was so great, she died before she took the second one. Through an investigation by the Council Bluffs Police Department, the woman's death was linked to a previously identified FBI target, which in turn led to the drug trafficking organization. Further investigation connected the drug traffickers to the 17 overdoses and 6 deaths in 2022. At its peak, we believe this enterprise was responsible for distributing 500 to 1,000 pills every day here in our community, Cowell said. We've assessed the Sinaloa cartel to be the likely source of supply for these pills. From its base of operations in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel is considered to be one of the largest drug trafficking organizations in the world. They obtain precursor chemicals largely from China. They manufacture synthetic drugs in Mexico. They move these drugs into the United States. They collect, launder, and transfer the proceeds of their drug sales back home, Cowell said. And they support and enforce all of this activity with a gruesome level of violence. In closing his remarks, Westfall issued a challenge to would-be fentanyl dealers. Those who seek to distribute fentanyl should take notice of this case, Westfall said. It's an example of the consequences they will face if they continue to distribute this drug. And do not doubt our resolve to find, charge, and convict those who are responsible for distributing this drug. Because every trafficker stopped, every pill seized, is an opportunity to prevent this lethal drug from changing other lives and killing other victims. Among those convicted following the investigation were 3 Council Bluffs residents. Megan Kayleen Johnson, 27, who was sentenced in March to 14 years for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl resulting in death or serious bodily injury. Richard Andrew Null, 26, who was recently sentenced to 12 and a half years for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl and carrying a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. And Jarek Matthew McPherson, 30, who was sentenced recently to 10 years for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl. Next is COVID-19 spread in Iowa high. Hospitalizations are at their highest number in nearly a year, by Jared Strong. The weekly number of people admitted to Iowa hospitals who have COVID-19 recently reached its highest in nearly a year, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There were about 315 new admissions reported for the week that ended December 2nd, a 52% increase over the week prior. That is the most recent week for which the data is available. A new report is expected Friday. The number of new admissions has been increasing throughout November, but had a relatively dramatic spike that week following Thanksgiving. A similar spike happened a year ago, and admissions stayed about that level for the rest of December 2022. Overall COVID-19 activity in Iowa was high the week that ended December 2nd, according to the latest respiratory virus surveillance report published by the State Department of Health and Human Services. There are signs that influenza is also on the rise, but HHS rated its activity as low. During respiratory virus season, it's not unusual to see variations in the activity levels of different viruses due to a variety of factors, said Alex Carfrey, an HHS spokesperson. Iowans should practice good hand hygiene, stay home when they're sick, cover coughs and sneezes, and talk with their healthcare provider about the immunizations recommended for them or their family. COVID-19 vaccines are often free for people who have health insurance or through the CDC's Bridge Access Program, which has agreements with healthcare providers and pharmacies. The CDC has an online search to find vaccine providers, or people can call 800-232-0233 for help. In April, the state ended its requirement for clinical labs to report COVID-19 test results. The number of tests reported to the state is now less than half of what it was a year ago. In the latest HHS respiratory virus report, about 19% of the reported weekly tests were positive for infection. That is the highest percentage in at least a year and can indicate two things. There's high community transmission and a need for more testing to understand the full scope of the spread. Early in the coronavirus pandemic, the World Health Organization recommended that countries and states should wait until their positivity rates held below 5% before loosening restrictions meant to contain the virus. The state's weekly respiratory virus reports also have information about deaths that are attributed to COVID-19 and influenza. But in October, HHS modified how it reports those deaths. Previously, the department included a cumulative tally of the deaths for each year, which reset at the start of the flu season in early October. There were about 885 deaths in Iowa related to COVID-19 for the 2022-23 year, according to the HHS report for the week ending September 30th. Subsequent reports do not have the cumulative total and instead have an unlabeled line chart that shows the overall trend of deaths for the past year. They also include a death count for the week that is reported, but death reports can often be delayed for weeks or months. Because of that, HHS's weekly COVID-19 death reports in the past 2 months have deviated substantially from what the CDC reports for Iowa on its website. Since early October, HHS has reported a total of 35 deaths in its weekly reports, whereas the CDC has tallied more than 120 for that time period. HHS did not respond to requests to provide its COVID-19 death tally for this flu season. Now we turn to page 2, and this story titled Superstar Duo Open Free Toy Shop for the Needy by Kristen M. Hall of the Associated Press. Dateline, Nashville, Tennessee. When country music star Brad Paisley and his wife, actress Kimberly Williams Paisley, helped create a free grocery store in Nashville, Tennessee, their goal was to give families in need the ability to choose their own food in a place that felt like a normal store. This year, the store is offering that same dignity of choice to parents looking for gifts for the holiday season. During a recent 2-day event, 400 families shopped at a free toy store, stocked with brand new toys, video games, stuffed animals, scooters, clothes, makeup, and musical instruments. The emotional aspect of being able to give your child something your child wanted versus just something to sort of get you through the holidays, that's such a load off the minds of somebody who maybe didn't think they were going to be able to do that, Paisley said. Nashville resident Stephanie Brody got enrolled at the store when she was a caregiver to her mother, and they both enjoyed getting to shop for the foods that they needed for their diets. Her mom has since passed, and now she's taking care of 5 grandchildren, including 4 under the age of 15. Last week, Brody and her granddaughter, LaDelegant Hartsfield, picked out armloads of toys, musical instruments, beauty products, and clothes for the family, a much-needed blessing when she's trying to save money to replace a broken stove this year. It's a very much dignified process, and it gives you the freedom of choice, said Brody, who wore a Paisley print dress in honor of the Paisley family. So we have a choice in what we present to our children, and we have a choice in what we feed and put on the table, which of course empowers you. The Paisleys got a sneak peek before the free toy store opened, marveling over the stacks of gifts, wrapping station, Christmas trees, and holiday decorations. Volunteers and staff from Belmont University and the store spent hours unpacking and organizing all the donated toys into sections and decorating while listening to Christmas music. The celebrity couple brought the idea of a free grocery store to Nashville after seeing the concept years ago at the Unity Shop in Santa Barbara, California. When the store launched in early 2020, it was just weeks after a tornado hit the city and before the global pandemic made food access an immediate problem. The store and its staff adapted, turning into a food delivery service for older people and delivering 1 million meals in the first year of operation. The store has an enrollment process each year, and to qualify, a household's total annual income has to be at 200% or below the federal poverty line. In addition to the free groceries, Belmont University, where Paisley graduated, now offers additional services to low-income families, including financial literacy events, music therapy, and medicine management. People come on hard times, and we want this to be a safe, welcoming place for everybody, whether you're volunteering or whether you're needing the services, Williams Paisley said. It's just a community, and we're all in it together. Brody said the store and Belmont gave her a bridge to resources she needed, whether it was a cooking class or homework help, especially when taxes, inflation, and real estate prices have made it harder to live in Nashville. I love Nashville. I don't want to get pushed out, and this has afforded me to be able to stay here for another year, Brody said. The store received about 2,000 donated items, about half of which came from the Nashville area and the other half from First Responders Children's Foundation, and raised $20,000. Parents will be able to drop off their kids at a church next door where they can play and drink hot chocolate while the adults shop and get gifts wrapped. There are plans for the store to become a recurring event, but Williams Paisley noted the store would need year-round donations to keep people fed. We're still not serving everybody that we want to serve. Food insecurity is on the rise. The USDA just released its report saying 17 million households in this country are facing food insecurity, and that's on the rise from 2021, Williams Paisley said. There's so much we want to do, and really, like the toy store has shown us that we can keep going and we can keep expanding and growing. Paisley admits this is his favorite season of the year, even suggesting he might show up at the toy store in a Santa costume. Also from page 2, MI6 Chief thanks Russian state television by Emma Burrows. Dateline London. The head of Britain's Foreign Intelligence Agency thanked Russian state television for its, quote, help encouraging Russian spies to spy for the United Kingdom after it translated and broadcast part of a speech he gave this year in which he called on Russians to join hands with us. Author Maria Butina, herself a former Russian spy, included the clip at the top of a program about Richard Moore, the head of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, also known as MI6. Moore gave the speech in July at the British Embassy in Prague, where he openly encouraged Russians faced with, quote, the venality, infighting, and sheer callous incompetence of their leaders, unquote, to spy for Britain. On Monday, Moore tweeted that the British Foreign Intelligence Agency has been, quote, puzzling over how to get my message to our target audience in Russia. We never thought Russian state TV would step in to help. Unquote. Thanks, folks, he added. Mark Galeotti, an expert in Russian security services at University College London, told the Associated Press the translation and broadcast of Moore's comments was a pretty serious gaffe. Butina's viewers are likely to be the kind of people that British intelligence would be interested in, Galeotti said, adding that he would not discount the prospect of the message being successful. Quote, intelligence work is about throwing crumbs out onto the water, unquote, and hoping someone will nibble, he said. Butina introduced the clip at the start of an hour-long program on Channel 1 in September about the MI6 chief and appeared to scoff at the suggestion that Russians would spy for the UK. Accusing Moore of employing, quote, cheap recruiting methods, she questioned whether he was seriously asking Russians, quote, to buy into the shameless provocation, unquote. Butina is a former covert Russian agent who spent more than a year in prison in the United States after admitting that she sought to infiltrate conservative U.S. political groups and promote Russia's agenda around the time that Donald Trump rose to power. Butina told the AP via telegram that she was shocked that the MI6 chief was interested in her show. Labeling Moore's position as desperate and weak, she questioned whether MI6 is so incompetent that they are unable to translate their content from English to Russian by themselves and deliver it to whomever they believe is their audience, that they need Russian TV to do so, unquote. When asked whether she helped the UK's Foreign Intelligence Agency to spread its message to Russians, she suggested if Moore had watched the full program, he would have seen the, quote, unpleasant and ugly portrayal of himself and MI6. Now turning to the Nation and the World page, we have Santos's attorney is optimistic. Former lawmaker is in plea discussions over several alleged crimes. By Philip Marcello. Central Islip, New York is the dateline. Former U.S. Representative George Santos's lawyer expressed optimism about plea negotiation in Santos's criminal fraud case Tuesday, successfully fending off prosecutors' attempts to speed up the ousted congressman's trial. In Santos's first court appearance since he was expelled from Congress this month, his attorney, Joseph Murray, argued that it was premature to bring the September trial forward while the two parties were in talks to resolve the case. "We should focus on the plea deal. I believe they can be fruitful," Murray told Judge Joanna Siebert in the federal court in Long Island. He also argued that he was struggling to keep up with voluminous materials produced by the government during the discovery process. Siebert sided with Murray, saying she would try to move the case as expeditiously as possible, but that September seemed like the earliest possible date on her current caseload. She set the next hearing in the case for January 23rd. Santos declined to comment on the case to reporters as he left the courthouse, saying to one, "It's cold, go home." This month, Santos became only the sixth lawmaker in history to be expelled from the U.S. House of Representatives. In an interview with WABC Radio that aired early Tuesday morning, Santos said he hopes to eventually regain the trust of the American people and return to public office. "I'm not done with public service. I want to go back to Congress," he said. "I'm not saying today, I'm not saying tomorrow. I'm 35, I have a lot of things I need to take care of first. I think we all know." The ex-lawmaker faces a slew of criminal charges, including allegations that he defrauded campaign donors, lied to Congress about his wealth, received unemployment benefits while employed, and used campaign contributions to pay for personal expenses, including designer clothing. Among the charges are allegations that he made unauthorized charges on credit cards belonging to some of his donors. Santos pleaded not guilty to a revised indictment in October. Prosecutors revealed in a court filing Monday that they were negotiating with Santos to potentially resolve his criminal case without a trial. Turning to the Briefly column, the first brief is conversion therapy. The Supreme Court on Monday refused to take up a case about whether state and local governments can enforce laws banning conversion therapy for LGBTQ+ children. Over the dissent of three conservative justices, the court turned away an appeal from Washington where the ban was upheld. Leaked documents. The Air Force disciplined 15 people connected to the massive classified documents leak by Air National Guard member Jack Texera, 21, this year, concluding that officials intentionally failed to take required action on his suspicious behavior, the Air Force Inspector General reported Monday. Navalny missing. The whereabouts of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny were unknown Monday, as officials at the penal colony where he is serving his sentence told one of his lawyers that he is no longer on the inmate roster, his spokeswoman Kira Yarmish said. Maine shooting. A tissue sample from the brain of Robert Card, the gunman who killed 18 people and injured 13 others in Maine, was sent to a lab in Massachusetts to be examined for signs of injury or trauma related to his service in the Army Reserves, officials said Monday. Parade deaths. Robert Crimo III, the man accused of killing 7 people at a July 4th parade in suburban Chicago last year, fired his public defenders on Monday and said he plans to represent himself at trial, slated to start in February. Alabama brawl. A man filmed swinging a folding chair during an Alabama riverfront brawl in August, pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge Monday. The man was ordered to perform community service and given a suspended sentence. Election worker details effects of Giuliani lies. Scared for her life after Rudy Giuliani and other Donald Trump allies falsely accused her of fraud, former Georgia election worker Wandria Shay Moss told jurors Tuesday she seldom leaves her home and she suffers from panic attacks and battles nightmares brought on by threatening and racist messages she received. Wandria Shay Moss took the witness stand on the second day of the defamation trial that will determine how much the former New York City mayor will have to pay Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, for spreading a conspiracy theory that they rigged the state's 2020 election results. Moss noted Giuliani just a day earlier repeated the false claims about her and her mother, saying they were engaged in changing votes. The judge overseeing the case already found Giuliani liable, and Giuliani acknowledged in court that he made false claims about Moss and her mother, who seek tens of millions of dollars in damages from him. Pakistan. A suicide bomber detonated his explosive-laden vehicle at a police station's main gate in northwestern Pakistan early Tuesday, killing at least 23 troops, wounding 32, and causing part of the building to collapse, authorities said. Ship struck. A missile fired by Yemen's Houthi rebels slammed into a Norwegian-flagged tanker in the Red Sea off the coast of Yemen near a key maritime choke point, the rebels and authorities said Tuesday. Plot. German prosecutors said Tuesday they filed terrorism charges against 27 people, including a self-styled prince and a former far-right lawmaker, over an alleged plot to topple the government that came to light with a slew of arrests a year ago. Transgender athlete. Florida's State Athletic Board fined a high school $16,500 and put it on probation Tuesday after a transgender student played on the girls' volleyball team, a violation of the controversial law enacted by Governor Ron DeSantis and the legislature. TikTok. A federal judge in Texas upheld that state's TikTok ban on official devices and networks Monday, rejecting a challenge brought by an organization that claimed the restrictions violate the First Amendment. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, December 13th, 2023, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Next, we'll turn to today's obituary. There's only one obituary today, Anthony Tony Staum. June 16, 1975 to December 11, 2023. Anthony George Tony Staum, age 48, passed away December 11, 2023. He was born June 16, 1975 to George and Judith Botts Staum in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Tony graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School. He enjoyed fixing and working with cars or anything with a motor that he could repair. He worked many years with his father at Staum Construction. Tony enjoyed spending time with his family and friends, and most of all, his dog, Gigi. He was preceded in death by his father, George Staum, brother, George John Staum, Jr., and Anthony is survived by his mother, Judith Staum, brothers and sisters, Joe and Jenny Staum, Christine and Brian Bonnet, John Staum, and Chris Wrinkle. Nieces and nephews, Mike Christensen, Aaron Taylor, Carrie Melcher, George Staum, Georgiana Bonnet, Sam Bonnet, cousins, aunts, and uncles, and a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be at 5 p.m. with Trisagion prayer service at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, December 14, 2023, at Hoy Kalnowski Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 12 p.m. at St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church on Friday, December 15th, 2023. The family will direct memorials. Now turning to the sports page, the headline is AFC up for grabs. All four division races could come down to the final week, by Rob Matty, Associated Press. The AFC is up for grabs with 4 weeks remaining in the regular season. Three of the conference's four division leaders lost in week 14, tightening the playoff picture and keeping the race for number one seed wide open. Only the AFC North leading Baltimore Ravens, 10-3, earned a win, and barely. They escaped with an overtime victory over the Rams on a walk-off punt return. Lamar Jackson and the Ravens have made the inside track to secure a first-round bye and home field advantage throughout the playoffs, but they have a difficult schedule down the stretch, starting with a trip to Jacksonville to face the AFC South leading Jaguars 8-5 this Sunday night. The Ravens then visit San Francisco on Christmas night and host AFC East leading Miami and Pittsburgh to close out the season. If they falter, the Cleveland Browns are closing in, with veteran Joe Flacco stepping up and providing stability at quarterback. The Browns still have a chance to win the division. If they win out and the Ravens go 2-2 with one loss to the Steelers, or both losses to the 49ers and Jaguars, the Browns will win their first division title since 1989. Miami's collapse on Monday night against the Titans opened the door for Buffalo to have a chance at winning its fourth straight AFC East title. If Buffalo is able to close the gap to one game over the next 3 weeks, the division will come down to week 18 when the Bills visit the Dolphins. The Bills host Dallas, visit the Chargers, and host the Patriots. The Dolphins host the Jets and Cowboys before visiting Baltimore. The Bills won the first meeting, so they'd have a chance to sweep the season series and take first place. The Jaguars have dropped two in a row to allow Houston and Indianapolis to stay close, but they still have a strong chance to repeat in the South. Those odds will shrink if they don't upset Baltimore this week. Jacksonville's final three games are a bit easier. The Jaguars visit Tampa Bay, host Carolina, and finish at Tennessee. The biggest surprise in the AFC is Kansas City's loosening grip on the West. The Chiefs have lost two in a row, while the Broncos have won 6 of 7 to make things interesting. If Denver wins out and the Chiefs lose to either the Raiders or the Chargers, the Broncos would end Kansas City's 7-year run of division dominance. The road back to the Super Bowl for the Eagles has suddenly hit a detour. Consecutive lopsided losses to the 49ers and Cowboys have exposed Philadelphia's flaws. A once dynamic offense is struggling, and the defense can't stop anybody. But help is on the way. The schedule gets easier. The Eagles face four losing teams to close out the season and would overtake Dallas to win the NFC East if they win out. First up is a trip to Seattle next Monday night. Then it's Tommy DeVito and the Giants, twice in 3 weeks sandwiched around a road game against the Cardinals. DeVito has become an overnight sensation in New York after leading the Giants to 3 straight wins and giving them an opportunity to stay in the playoff race at one game behind several 6-7 teams. Flacco, a Super Bowl MVP a decade ago, came off his couch to help the Browns stay competitive and become Cleveland's fourth starting quarterback this season. Jake Browning has stepped in for John Burrow and lifted the Bengals back into the playoff race with impressive performances in wins over Jacksonville and Indianapolis. Even Zach Wilson returned from the bench to have perhaps the best game of his career in the Jets' convincing win over Houston. Now turning to Major League Baseball, South Korean outfielder Jung-Hoo Lee gets $113 million and a 6-year deal from the Giants, AP source says. South Korean outfielder Jung-Hoo Lee and the San Francisco Giants have agreed to a $113 million 6-year contract, according to an AP source. Lee, a South Korean MVP and the son of a former MVP, can terminate the deal after 4 years and a $72 million to become a free agent again. The 25-year-old Lee was posted by South Korea's Kiwoom Heroes on December 4th, and if he stays for the entire contract, the Giants would owe the Heroes $18,825,000 posting fee. If he opts out, the posting fee would be reduced to $12,675,000. San Francisco also would owe an additional fee of 15% for any earned bonuses or escalators. Lee hit 318 with 6 homers and 48 RBIs in 86 games this year, a season cut short when he broke his left ankle during a game against the Lotte Giants on July 22nd. Lee batted 349 in 2022 when he set career bests of 23 homers and 113 RBIs in 142 games. Lee hit 429 with 2 doubles and 5 RBIs for South Korea in this year's World Baseball Classic, where South Korea failed to advance from its first round group. He batted 241 with 3 doubles, 1 homer, and 3 RBIs in the 2021 Olympics, where South Korea lost to the United States in the semifinals and to the Dominican Republic for the bronze medal. In his first public comments since the New York Yankees acquired him from San Diego, 3-time All-Star Juan Soto deflected questions about a possible long-term deal with the Yankees. The 25-year-old outfielder said the team could deal with his agent, Scott Boras. Soto spoke 6 days after he was acquired by the Yankees from San Diego, along with Gold Glove center fielder Trent Grisham for right-handed pitchers Michael King, Johnny Brito, Randy Vasquez, and Drew Thorpe, plus catcher Kyle Higashioka. Soto hit 275 with 35 homers, 109 RBIs, and a 930 OPS in his only full season with the Padres. He has 4 homers in 6 career games and 23 at-bats in Yankee Stadium. Royals. According to AP sources, right-handers Seth Lugo and Chris Stratton agreed to deals with the Royals. Lugo will make $45 million over 3 seasons and can opt out after the 2025 season, while Stratton will make $3.5 million this season with $4.5 million player option for 2025. Lugo is coming off a strong season with the Padres where he proved he could be a regular start, while Stratton helped solidify what was one of the worst bullpens in baseball last season. The Mets. Infield prospect Ronnie Mauricio tore the ACL in his right knee during a Dominican Winter League game and will need surgery. The injury will sideline him for a significant part of the 2024 season. The 22-year-old, who made his Major League debut on September 1st, hit 248 with 2 homers, 9 RBIs, and 7 steals for the Mets in September. The Nationals. Washington finalized a $2.25 million one-year contract with reliever Dylan Floro and a $2 million one-year deal with infielder-outfielder Nick Senzel. The right-handed Floro was 5-6 with a 4.76 ERA and 7 saves for Miami and Minnesota last season. Senzel hit 236 with 13 homers and 42 RBIs for Cincinnati. Tigers. Detroit finalized left-hander Andrew Chafin's $4.75 million one-year contract. Chafin gets $4.25 million next year, and the deal includes a $6.5 million team option for 2025 with a $500,000 buyout. Chafin was 2-3 with a 2.83 ERA in 2022, striking out 67 and walking 19 in 57 and a third innings. The Brewers. Milwaukee finalized Joe Ross's $1.75 million one-year contract. The right-hander hasn't pitched since August 2021 after having Tommy John surgery. He is 26-28 with a 4.26 ERA in 76 career starts and 22 relief appearances, striking out 403, walking 141 in 443 and a third innings. Pirates. Pittsburgh agreed to a $3.2 million one-year contract with first baseman designated hitter Rowdy Tellez. The 28-year-old hit 215 with 13 home runs and 47 RBI for Milwaukee last season. The left-handed Tellez is a career 233 hitter in 6 seasons with Toronto and Milwaukee. And the Guardians? Cleveland added depth to its starting rotation, agreeing to a $750,000 one-year contract with right-hander Ben Lively. The 31-year-old split last season between Cincinnati and AAA Louisville. In 12 starts for the Reds, he went 4-7 with a 5.38 ERA. Now we have NFL notes. Herbert done for season after having finger surgery. Dateline Costa Mesa, California. Justin Herbert had surgery on Tuesday on his broken index finger on his right hand and will miss the Los Angeles Chargers' remaining four games this season. Herbert visited two hand specialists on Monday after he suffered the injury during the second quarter of Los Angeles' 24-7 loss to the Denver Broncos on Sunday. "He is tough as they come, but we're going to make sure that whatever it is, we're going to do what is best for Justin long term," Coach Brandon Staley said on Monday. Easton Stick will get his first NFL start on Thursday night at Las Vegas against the Raiders. The Chargers are 5-8 and have dropped four of their past five. And briefly, the Vikings. Nick Mullins will be starting quarterback for Minnesota this Saturday at Cincinnati. He relieved an ineffective Joshua Dobbs last week and helped lead the Vikings to a 3-0 victory at Las Vegas. Mullins is the fourth different starter for the Vikings. They've never used that many in the same season before in franchise history. Dobbs arrived in a trade with Arizona after Kirk Cousins tore his Achilles tendon. Browns. Cleveland lost its second starting offensive tackle in 2 days as Jedrick Wills Jr. underwent season-ending knee surgery. Wills had been on injured reserve since November 7th, and the Browns had hoped the left tackle would be able to return at some point this season. However, the 2020 first-round pick from Alabama elected to have an operation and won't be back until 2024. Rams. Los Angeles cut veteran kicker Mason Crosby from their practice squad after incumbent Lucas Haverzik had a strong game at Baltimore. The Rams also placed rookie long snapper Alex Ward on injured reserve and signed veteran long snapper Carson Tinker. Crosby signed with Los Angeles last week, returning to the NFL after his 16-year career in Green Bay ended last winter. And the Ravens. Baltimore activated defensive back Pepe Williams off injured reserve. Williams hasn't played this season because of ankle problems. He appeared in 14 games last season as a rookie. The Ravens designated Williams to return from IR on November 21st, but did not activate him until now. Now we have men's college basketball top 25 roundup. Filipowski's almost triple-double helps Duke pull away from Hofstra. Dateline Durham, North Carolina. Kyle Filipowski knocked down shots, attacked the glass, and set up teammates on kickouts. By the end of the night, he had flirted with a triple-double while number 21 Duke pulled away after halftime for a comfortable win. The 7-foot preseason Associated Press All-American had 28 points, 12 rebounds, and a career-best 8 assists as the Blue Devils beat Hofstra 89-68 on Tuesday night, turning in a productive all-around performance that included 4 three-pointers and 3 block shots. Coach John Shayer said Filipowski was just a force, coming after he had just 17 points in his previous 2 games combined and shot 2-for-10 in his last outing. "I think for me it was just a little mental," Filipowski said, "but I've got a great supporting cast, great teammates, great coaches. They keep their confidence high in me. And when I don't overthink it, things tend to go really well. Getting out of that funk, just playing, having fun, it's a great feeling." Duke shot 55%, made 11 of 22 three-pointers, and had 4 players in double figures while playing again without injured point guard Tyrese Proctor. Jeremy Roach added 19 points and 8 assists for Duke, which trailed 37-32 late in the first half before closing on a 12-2 burst before the break. That included a run of 5 straight made shots, a flurry that continued into the second half as Filipowski hit 1 right corner 3 and then another to eventually push Duke to a 55-43 lead. Number 12, Tennessee, beats Georgia Southern. Jonas Adu had 29 points and 11 rebounds, and number 12 Tennessee beat Georgia Southern 74-56 on Tuesday night. The winless Eagles had no answer for the 6'11" Adu, who also had 2 steals and 2 blocks. Adu was the only double-digit scorer for the Volunteers. After trailing by as many as 28 points shortly after halftime, Georgia Southern cut the difference to 13 points with a 10-point spurt midway through the second half. Derek Harris came off the bench to score all but 2 of his 13 points in the second half for the Eagles. Adu scored for the first 10 points of the game and had 21 by halftime as the Vols led 49-21. Now turning to the National Hockey League. Leafs increase point streak to 7 games. Dateline New York. Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner each scored twice, and veteran Martin Jones made 28 saves in his first start for Toronto as the Maple Leafs beat the New York Rangers 7-3 on Tuesday. Matthews added 2 assists, and the Maple Leafs also got goals from Connor Timmins and Callie Jarncrock to improve to 5-0-2 in their last 7 games. Toronto led 4-1 after 20 minutes, but New York scored twice in the second period to narrow the deficit to 1 before Marner got his 2nd of the night on a power play in the 3rd. Blake Wheeler scored twice, and Micah Zabajad had a goal for the Rangers, who lost for the first time in 4 games. Penguins 4, Coyotes 2. Jeff Carter and Jake Guentzel both scored twice, and Pittsburgh's beleaguered power play showed signs of life as the Penguins slipped past visiting Arizona. Hurricanes 4, Senators 1. Sebastian Aho had 2 goals and an assist to lead Carolina over host Ottawa. Peter Kochetkov made 31 saves as the Hurricanes snapped a 4-game skid. Red Wings 6, Blues 4. Robbie Fabry and Lucas Raymond scored in the 3rd period to lift visiting Detroit over scuffling St. Louis. Kevin Hayes scored twice for the Blues. Predators 3, Flyers 2 in overtime. Philip Forsberg scored 18 seconds into overtime, and Nashville held off visiting Philadelphia after the Flyers rallied for a 2-0 deficit late in the game. Canucks 4, Lightning 1. Brock Boeser picked up a natural hat trick with 2 second-period goals and another goal late in the 3rd period as Vancouver beat visiting Tampa Bay. Kraken 4, Panthers 0. Joey Decord made 24 saves for his first career shutout, and Seattle scored 3 goals in the 3rd period to beat visiting Florida and end an 8-game slide. Golden Knights 6, Flames 5 in overtime. Calgary's Jaeger Sharangovich tied the game with 1 minute left in regulation, but Vegas's Mark Stone scored 1 minute and 11 seconds into overtime for the home victory. Oilers 4, Blackhawks 1. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Sam Gagner scored in the 1st period, and Edmonton cruised to a win over visiting Chicago, which got a goal from Connor Baird. Here are the games for today. Wednesday's games. New Orleans at Washington at 6 p.m. Philadelphia at Detroit at 6 p.m. Atlanta at Toronto at 6:30 p.m. Charlotte at Miami at 6:30 p.m. Indiana at Milwaukee at 7 p.m. L.A. Lakers at San Antonio, 7 p.m. Memphis at Houston at 7 p.m. Brooklyn at Phoenix at 8 p.m. New York at Utah at 8 p.m. And then Thursday's games are Chicago at Miami at 6:30 p.m., Cleveland at Boston, 6:30, Minnesota at Dallas, 7:30 p.m., Brooklyn at Denver, 8 p.m., Oklahoma City at Sacramento at 9, Utah at Portland at 9, and Golden State at L.A. Clippers, 9:30 p.m. And Wednesday's games are Boston at New Jersey, 6 p.m., Pittsburgh at Montreal, 6 p.m., Anaheim at New York Islanders, 6:30, Buffalo at Colorado, 8:30, and Winnipeg at Los Angeles at 9:30. Thursday's games are Columbus at Toronto, 6 p.m., Washington at Philadelphia, 6, Carolina at Detroit, 6:30, Calgary at Minnesota, 7 p.m., Ottawa at St. Louis, 7 o'clock, Tampa Bay at Edmonton, 8 p.m., Chicago at Seattle, 9, and Florida at Vancouver at 9 p.m. And around the league, motivated Rantanen breaks out of slump, Dateline Denver. Avalanche forward Mikko Rantanen said he had added incentive for his big game Monday night after taking offense to comments from the dad of one of his teammates concerning his off-season work ethic. Ismo Lekkonen, a hockey analyst and the father of injured Avalanche forward Arturi Lekkonen, told Finnish public broadcaster YLE earlier Monday that Rantanen's recent slump may be because he didn't have a terribly swell summer. Rantanen responded with a goal and two assists, including a pass that helped set up the winner by Nathan MacKinnon in a 6-5 comeback against Calgary. "It feels good. It's actually one thing where I got a lot of extra energy," Rantanen said after the game. One of our Finnish NHL players' dads was talking expletive about me in the media, but I didn't train last summer like I used to. He was making things up. That was for him. If you talk expletive, it's going to come back at you. Rantanen's teammate and fellow countryman, Arturi Lekkonen, had been sidelined with a neck injury since November 9th. In a translation of the story on the YLE website, Ismo Lekkonen said of Rantanen, "There were a lot of parties going on. He had to be in Helsinki and all that. He probably wanted to cool down on purpose after hard years, and maybe he didn't do sports quite the same as before." Rantanen leads the Avalanche with 13 goals despite his recent slump. And the stat of the day, 500. Jamie Benn recorded his 500th career assist on Monday. Benn joined Mike Modano and Neil Broughton as the only players to reach the milestone for the Stars. Benn also tied Broughton with 867 career points. Modano holds the franchise record at 1,359. And that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, December 13th, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.